You are listening to the Poetry Salon Cast, brought to you by the Poetry Salon. The Poetry Salon is on a mission to make inspiration, education, and an inspiring community affordable and available to poets and writers around the world. To find out more about our workshops, classes, editing services, and events, visit www.thepoetrysalon.com. Now, please enjoy our interview with this month's guest poet. Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Poetry Salon Cast. Today, I will be interviewing Jose Hernandez Diaz. Jose Hernandez Diaz was born in Anaheim, California. He holds degrees in English and creative writing from the University of California, Berkeley, and Antioch University, Los Angeles. His poetry and prose poetry appears in The Best American Non-Required Reading, Green Mountains Review, Huizach, The Journal, Los Angeles Review, New American Writing, Pleiades, The Progressive, Rattle, Whiskey Island, Witness, and other journals. Gigantic Sequins and Parcel have been nominated for Pushcart Prizes. He has served as an editorial intern for Floricanto Press and poetry editor for Lunch Ticket. His first full-length collection is Bad Mexican, Bad American, out from Acre Books. Please welcome Jose Hernandez Diaz.
The Skeleton and the Pyramid. A skeleton with a sombrero sat on top of an Aztec pyramid. The sun was shining. Sun was setting. He played a song on his old guitar. It was called The Jaguar Moon. At the end of the song, he took a bow for the small crowd that had gathered. The tourists clapped and tipped the skeleton plenty of pesos. The skeleton climbed down from the pyramid and bought a paleta de coco. It was his favorite flavor since childhood. The moon rose like a child's rainbow kite. Eventually, the skeleton finished the paleta and disappeared into the crowd of restless tourists. This next prose poem is called My Life as a French Existential Novelist, and it was published in Pithead Chapel. After I fell down the stairs last Easter, I was suddenly able to speak French. I moved to Paris immediately. I got a job at an old bookstore that Apollinaire used to frequent. I bought a French bulldog, of course. On the weekends, I smoked too many cigarettes and rode the subway aimlessly. My French name was Gaston, like in Beauty and the Beast, except I had no bell. I'd always wanted to be a French existentialist. Now that I was one, I refused to wear a beret or the color black. My fatal flaw is that I think people are always looking at me. In fact, it's just that I was born a handsome child. That's the persona, right? Still, the moon shines more beautifully in Paris, France. The clouds more beautiful.
That is the voice of Jose Hernandez Diaz. Jose, thank you so much for being here. It's really a pleasure to finally get to talk to you.
Oh, my pleasure.
Yes, yeah, so I think you and I have been, friends on Facebook for a number of years, and I've enjoyed seeing the poems that you post. And when I saw that you have had a book forthcoming, I think a while ago, I reached out and asked if you would be on. And I just finished reading the book, Bad Mexican, Bad American, and it's terrific. I wanted to ask a little bit about how that book came into being. What started it, and, you know, when did you feel like it was finished?
Yeah, you know, this book, a lot of it, the organization of it, the origins of it came about with my first collection. This is technically my second full-length written manuscript, but the first manuscript, I kept submitting it. It was called The Parachutist. It has a similar structure insofar as it is linear verse. In the first half, linear verse autobiographical, linear verse about my real life in the first section of the book, and then the second half, primarily surreal, absurd prose poetry. So I learned how to organize it, how to make it somewhat cohesive from the first manuscript. So luckily with this manuscript, I was able to put it together relatively easily because of that process. And I had been submitting the first one. It was finalist with a lot of things, National Poetry Series, different things. And I have this other one, and I said, I'm going to start submitting them at the same time. I thought you had to wait or something, but I said, I just realized, oh, I didn't even know you could have two books at once, you know, manuscripts. So they kind of piled up there with the 5 years waiting, you know. And I originally had called it The Magician. But then I said, Bad Mexican, Bad American sounds like more like a title, you know, and it represents like the Mexican American Chicano bicultural experience and ni de aquí, ni de allá sort of subtext of it. And also, I felt like The Magician represented the surrealist aspect of it, but it sort of neglected the first section of the book, which is autobiographical, real life, you know, growing up first gen Mexican American in Northern Orange County in Southeast LA. So I said, I didn't want to rely on a title that sort of like, I feel like it's kind of like a shocking title. So I felt like, oh, I don't want to do that. But finally, I posted that I was thinking about making this a title on Twitter. And everybody was like, oh, yeah, that's the title. They kind of convinced me.
And, I absolutely hear you on that. And it is a terrific title for the book. The cover, could you say a little bit about the cover of the book and describe it for those who haven't gotten a copy yet?
The cover is blue and turquoise. It has a iconic looking Chicano figure, shirtless, sort of like Cholo SoCal style, with some Chuck Taylors, and the head is the head of an Aztec eagle. You know, the eagle warriors were prominent in the Aztec civilization. So it has, instead of the head, the human head, it has an eagle warrior depiction. And originally I had another similar art piece from the same artist that I had selected. But the artist did not have a photograph, a quality photograph of the illustration. So then he said, I have three new ones that you can pick from these ones. And I picked this one. And I think it worked out.
No, the cover is really perfect for it. And it does say so much in just one image. You know, it is surreal. It's got that modern day, you know, just a person wearing you know, tennis shoes and shorts, and yet there's definitely a callback to, you know, the eagle head means so many things. It's nature, but it's also really kind of a signifier of Mexican culture. And the fact that it's a person wearing one definitely signals to the reader, like, this is going to be a book with some surrealism. I think that cover works so well for the book. It's interesting reading a writer when you're already kind of familiar with their work out of order, and then you get into the book, because I read the first section, which is very autobiographical, and I remember thinking towards the end of the section, the beginning section, going, I wonder if he's going to have any of his more surreal work that I'm familiar with. I wonder if that's going to play in at all. And then the next section, you know, really takes off into the surrealism. I think the poem that you read, The Skeleton in the Pyramid, that first poem you read, The Skeleton in the Pyramid, is what opens up the second section of the book. And from there, it's kind of all surrealism all the time. And I really appreciate both. I write a lot of autobiographical things. I encourage people to write a lot of autobiography, but I'm a big fan of surrealism. And the book is doing some things that I will confess I don't really know how to do myself, but I'm really fascinated when other people can do them. So I'm wondering if you would talk a little bit about your writing process. Where do you get the ideas And do you have a different process for writing a more surreal piece than writing a more, obviously autobiographical, realistic piece?
Initially I was sort of worried about that split in aesthetics or, dichotomy of autobiographical surreal. And I thought it's not going to mesh well as a full collection. It's kind of like water and oil, And then I said, you know what? If I just present an autobiographical collection, it's great and it represents me, but it's missing like the surreal, creative, innovative aspect of my personality, my aesthetics, my writing. And if I just present the surreal, like in the Fire Eater, the prose poems together, I had people asking me, well, where are your Chicano like autobiographical poems? Like you're asking me where the surreal when you start reading. And I have the other outcome when I write if when it's just the prose poems, So I said, you know what? I don't know if I've seen that too much, like two different like books in one almost. But I said, I'm gonna try it out, And I did also like the skeleton in the pyramid, it incorporates surrealism, but it also has Mexican references, imagery. And before that, I kind of thought the surrealism had to be universal, neutral, not culture specific. Like I saw a lot of Tate and a lot of writers doing, but I said, you know what? What's going to make my work unique and my own voice is incorporating those images. And one of the first ones I wrote was called The Jaguar, and it's talking about lifting weights in my garage, and suddenly there's a turquoise jaguar on top of my washing machine. So it was a way for me to have like both worlds of surrealism and then celebrating my heritage and culture. And so when I write autobiographical poems, it tends to be in linear verse, oftentimes couplets, with about a medium length line break. And yeah, they tend to come out in linear verse. And when I write surreal poems, they tend to be prose poetry, a lot of discovering as I write, not necessarily going to the canvas, so to speak, with an agenda. And when I'm writing autobiographical, it's not necessarily that I have an agenda, but I kind of have an idea. What I'm writing about is more based on like an actual experience. For example, Jorge Ramos is from Guanajuato, from another collection. It happened when my father was talking about Jorge Ramos on the news. This is like 10 years ago, but so a lot of my autobiographical work, it sort of mirrors reality and experiences that I have. And the surreal, it tends to be my playground with the imagination, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's so interesting, the idea of culturally specific surrealist imagery, culturally specific surrealism. And your book does have references to other poets in there, and I'd encourage readers to just take a look at the table of contents. I remember going over the table of contents and getting really quite nerdy and excited because you've got poems in there with titles that reference, Tate and what is it, the one about becoming an existential French novelist. It was like, oh, there's going to be a lot in here that I recognize, and at the same time there's going to be a lot in here that it was new to me, or kind of, I grew up, I spent a lot of time in Southern California, and I grew up in California overall, so it's like all of the Chicano and Chicana and Mexican literature and imagery and everything, like it's still pretty familiar to me, but it's still new in many ways too. So I felt like it was very it the book does a great job of letting the reader feel like they're being invited in to experience something with the speaker of the poem, the speaker of the poems. And we get some of the autobiographical background. But then for me, what the order of the book did is it felt like I really went on a journey. Like the beginning part is the opening world, the normal world, the everyday world. And then when you get to that second section, it's like, now we've entered the dream world together. And it just made me feel a little bit more like kind of stable with the person who wrote the poems. And then they opened up their, you know, their dream world to me. So I really enjoyed that. I think that was a great decision on your part.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear it, because I was a little bit anxious about how it would be perceived or received in the sense of the different styles, you know. So that was one of my big, you know, questions that I had about it.
Well, I think one of the things that works so well is that, you know, all of the poems feel like they have this, you know, plain spoken quality about them. They're all poetic, obviously, but, you know, there's typical syntax. I feel like the language is accessible, and you do feel like you're talking to a person about their life in that first section. And then the second section, the images get very surreal and strange, but the language remains very accessible, you know, very typical syntax. So, and I think that did a lot to lure me into the poems and showed me what language can do. It's not just about the language, you know, being decorous or purple prose, as we might say. But it's about the language painting a picture of something that isn't, you know, that's only dream quality. It's inventing things. And the language can do more than just be beautiful for its own sake. The language can also, like, create these images and pictures in our mind that are themselves, you know, archetypally engaging. So I just really appreciate that. It's very fun for me, you know, interviewing different poets. I see how every poet kind of has a different thing that they're doing that defines their work and shows us the many different ways that poetry can create beauty and all the many different facets a poem or a book of poems can have.
And also of that time period, you know, like to me, the Fire Eater, that was a, you know, my late 20s and sort of wild and experimental. And then, so each book kind of reflects a certain time period, you know, of the authors. You know, now I'm moving a little more to more description now, a little more interested in vocabulary and syntax. So, you know, writers go through different phases and different styles as well. So, yeah, I think when I read James Tate, and I noticed he had this like stripped down quality to it, minimalist, deadpan approach. I said, that sounds interesting, you know. Back then I was into like, well, I still am, but like underground hip hop and indie rock and the counterculture. And so I like subversive, you know, the beats when I was younger. So I felt like Tate was a way to incorporate some subversive qualities and still be respected by the, you know, he won a Pulitzer and he won, you know, National Book Award. So it was kind of a way to like be unique and subversive while still being respected, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I sometimes ask this at the end of the interview, but since we're on the topic, I'd love to know, who are some of the influences you were reading at this time? Obviously, you know, you mentioned Tate, but are there other poets that you felt really were influencing this book specifically?
Well, I've kind of read a lot of contemporary poetry. I would say Tate was a big influence, but the other writers I kind of discovered later, as I was already establishing my voice in surreal prose poetry. But, you know, some of my favorite authors, Alberto Rios, Ada Limón, Francisco Alarcón, who was an early poet that I read, Juan Felipe Herrera, Diane Seuss, Terence Hayes. But as far as influencing this book and the writing, I would say it's just sort of like everything you ever learned coming together into your own voice, you know, and the poems. I feel sometimes like you hear a lot of white writers, if they mention me, they'll say, oh, well, Tate and Edson came up first and he's standing on their shoulders. And it's always white males that say that. And I'm like, yeah, they definitely influenced me, but you're never going to write a quality poem if you're just mimicking somebody. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
You have to make it your own. You have to have your own voice. Like I said, I doubt Tate would write about skeletons and pyramids and jaguars, you know? So that was my culture being influenced into the surrealism. And I definitely give props to Tate. You know, he opened that world to me. I didn't know about prose poetry before that, but it's important for me to stand on my own. And it's like Kobe Bryant learned how to play basketball from Michael Jordan, you know, during the 96 All-Star game. He picked up, you know, he picked his brain and everything, and that was his idol. But you still have to learn how to shoot on your own and your own moves. And so that's for me, like Tate is a teacher of mine. I never met him, but just through his books. But the other, you know, Simic and these other prose poets, I kind of learned after. I read after. I already had Marosa de Giorgio, Russell Edson, Sabrina Oramark. These are writers that I teach in my workshops, you know. But I wouldn't say that it was like stylistically I had sort of learned from them. Tate was like the big one for me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would never have read any of your writing and thought, you know, I think he's imitating Tate. You know, if the poems didn't reference him specifically, it never would have occurred to me, really, because you're right. They are, especially subject matter in the terms of the imagery that you are using, they're definitely all coming from a different place. I'd say they're all your own, but I don't really think any of us can claim that anything is all our own. We're all like influenced by what we see and hear and see around us, but they're absolutely coming from different place than Tate's are. So I wanted to ask too about musical influences, especially since I think it's in the third section of the book. Many of the poems begin with a man wearing a Rage Against the Machine shirt, or a man wearing a Chicano Batman shirt, these pop culture references. Can you speak a little bit about how those have influenced you?
Yeah, I wanted to be in a band when I was younger. I like Rage Against the Machine and a lot of the bands from Southern California, Sublime, a lot of underground hip-hop, MF Doom, Pink Floyd. So I was always into music kind of first and then poetry after. I would read Rage Against the Machine's lyrics when I was in high school and try to write like Zach De La Rocha. So it's always been it, like with these prose poems, I'm trying to pay homage to those bands. And make it interesting to me. Poetry doesn't have to be boring and always like only referencing like Greek gods or something, you know. So it was a way for me to reference the bands I grew up with that influenced me. It had a sort of a quirky edge to it. And it was kind of nondescript. It was kind of like anonymous. Like instead of giving this character a name, he was called the man in the Pink Floyd shirt or the man in the Doom shirt, you know. And each person with each shirt has kind of their own style a little bit, like based on the shirt, you know. Chicano Batman shirt might have a little different vibe from the man in the Pink Floyd shirt. So it was just a way to play with persona, third-person prose poetry, pay homage to a lot of my musical influences. And I think with my work, sometimes there's a musicality to it. So I think a lot of that comes from listening to a lot of underground hip hop and rock and roll in my teenage and 20s, you know, my 20s and early 30s.
Yeah, I did wonder a little bit about that because the, you know, as we said, the first section of the book has so much that's overtly autobiographical. And then after that, the poems do become a little bit more anonymous. It's the man in this shirt, the man in that shirt. And towards the end of the book, there are some poems where it's, you know, this man has already died. There's a wonderful poem about, I'm gonna look up the name so I don't get it wrong, but it's towards the very end. I think it's just Bones. Yeah, there's the poem Bones where the man has already died, but he still goes on loving his wife from the grave and sends her these burgundy roses. So I thought, all right, well, probably this isn't overtly autobiographical. Probably rooted in real feelings that the poet really has and things, but you know, we can tell that this is not this is clearly not about something literal that happened. Although I don't know. I shouldn't put words in the poet's mouth, but I did want to know a little bit about what it means to depersonalize and make those poems not writing from the point of view of the I, but switching over to that third person.
It was just new territory, you know? It was painting with different colors, you know? Initially, when I started writing poetry, I was writing I and protest poetry, poems coming from the I perspective, first person, and like I said, politically charged protest poems against SB 1070 and just the overt racism of what it is to be American, which continues to this day. That's why, sometimes when I'm sending out my manuscripts, they tell me, well, how is this different from your other work? And I explain some of the differences, but I also say, I'm always going to write political, personal, socially conscious, because the Chicano and the Latino is always seen of as an other and a nuisance and an immigrant and in their own ancestral lands. So I'm always going to write about that, you know, even every political season, you know, the first thing is build the wall, deport. We're just like scapegoats. So I'm always going to have that interest in the personal. But what I'm doing with the prose poem and the surreal prose poem is it's sort of like a mask, a persona, a disguise, an escape, that we don't have to just write about the first person. We can create worlds, we can world build, and we can come in disguise, as Tate says. We can come in disguise in the prose poem. It's stripped down, it lulls you in with the language. Maybe if I'm having a bad day, I don't feel like writing a confessional poem today about feeling claustrophobic, so I can write, you know, a man woke up in a box. He started punching at the box. He realized he was getting shipped to England, so he went back inside the box. He had never been to England, despite being an English major. So, you know what I mean? Like, I can take this initial anxiety of feeling trapped that I had when I wrote that prose poem, and, you know, I don't have to write, I'm sad, feel bad for me. I'm 30 years old and I'm still sad. So I can be playful with it. You know what I mean? Like, and you can come in disguised, use a mask, metaphor, imagery, world build, you know? So it was just a creative outlet that was a little bit different from my personal political, which I feel I had to write, like, out of anger and opposition, resistance, and necessity. These ones were more sort of my intellectual or artistic playground of exploring and discovering and building, you know?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I've been very much, cluing into this idea of poem as world building recently, because I used to think of surrealism as this is a way to just heighten the metaphor. So that poem you were just talking about with, I feel claustrophobic. So instead it's going to be, I'm a man in a box and I'm being shipped to England and I've never been to England, even though I was an English major. You know, you could say that that's like a metaphor for feeling claustrophobic, is feeling like you're in a box, but it's also doing more than that. It is building this hypothetical world where things could happen that don't happen in the real world. And maybe it's just creating something that I don't know. I guess I think that's sort of a comment disguised as a question disguised as a comment. For you, is there a difference between coming in a disguise and using metaphor to talk about something that's real versus creating something maybe that's a little bit more created out of whole cloth?
Yeah, you know, it's like sometimes a political poem can be powerful, and just naming the thing for what it is, you know what I mean? Like overtly, directly. And there's power in that, and there's beauty in that. And then sometimes, like, you know, like a Rage Against the Machine song or a Pink Floyd song, which is a little more using metaphor and, you know, building up, you know, the floating pigs representing capitalism, you know, symbolic symbolism. So I think that either way is interesting in its own way. If you want to be direct, literal, autobiographical, realist, gritty, you know, I grew up first generation low income, so I can vibe with different styles, you know, and I grew up around different classes too, not just, you know, the lower middle class or the working class, but also the middle class, upper middle class. So I've had different, not that I was there, but like I had friends, you know, so I could kind of appreciate different styles of writing. Mm-hmm. I don't think everyone has to write the same poem, and that's okay. You know, I don't think just everybody should write social realism. I don't think everybody should just write surrealism. You know, I think that it's unique and interesting that people have different voices and their own aesthetics. And so I'm all about abundance and more writing and not limiting ourselves. And in the surrealism, you know, the surrealists used to just turn to a random page in a book and, okay, pillow, okay, an ode to a pillow, you know, like, so they would just start using some of the randomness, spontaneity, you know, their brethren were getting, you know, massacred in world wars, so meaning was like shattered, you know, so they kind of made sense out of reality in impulsive, random ways, you know. So I think there's just various vehicles for inspiration.
Absolutely. I also wanted to ask, do any of these poems come from dreams that you've had?
Maybe a couple of them, but it's more like the idea of the dream, you know, the dream logic. And, you know, I can meet Octavio Paz on Jupiter, and obviously this can't happen, but, you know, in my prose poem, I kind of set no limits, no boundaries. You know, one time I was talking to somebody who done a lot of time, and they read a lot of science fiction. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, I never understand why people like science fiction. This was years ago. And he said, it's an escape, you know? And it just hit me, and I was like, damn, that's deep, you know? So to me, that's kind of what my surrealism is, absurdism is. It's an escape from, you know, various personal struggles. And so that's what it is to me, is a way I can be free and just it's a high, you know, just to create something that wasn't there. Another world, you know, and it, like, I can't tell you which one I like more, the, you know, writing an autobiographical poem about my real life, maybe, like, you know, and I wrote a poem the other day called Ode to My Sister Letty for being the first in the family to go to college, you know. Mm-hmm. So they're equally meaningful to me, you know, and just a little bit different, you know. One of them is a little more creative, perhaps. The the surreal, and the other one is more about voice and empowerment and speaking truth to power and overcoming obstacles and sometimes not overcoming obstacles, you know. So it's just they're different. It's like saying, what do I like more, basketball or football? You know, I like them equally. You know, I love both of them in different ways, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, on that note, too, you have no reason to know this, but like I actually grew up in a very low income community. And both of my parents are differently abled, as we call it. So it was a very strange mix because the extended family had means and whatnot. Both of my parents had some college education, but we were in communities with a lot of folks. A lot of my classmates, their parents, you know, didn't necessarily have college education, things like that. Yeah. And what struck me in the first part of your book, I think there's a few poems that kind of take issue with some of the stereotypes around that. You know, there's one poem, and I'm afraid I'm going to probably mix it up, but where you, you know, the speaker of the poem says something like, hey, it wasn't all that bad. I mean, we were 8 people in a 2-bedroom apartment, but there was enough room there for us to like love and fight and quarrel and all this other stuff. And I,
yeah,
there was a part of me that was thinking, like, is he being sarcastic or is that's kind of genuine? Like it is bad, but it's really, you know, not wanting to dwell on that. Like it's still like, stop spending all this time pitying.
You know? Yeah, I was kind of a little bit like ambivalent about writing like those type of autobiographical poems. But, you know, when it comes down to it, now that I'm an adult, I can see the way I grew up was, you know, my parents immigrated from Mexico. You know, I don't mean this to belittle, but, you know, just they didn't have the opportunity to go to school and things like that. So they had to work minimum wage jobs, you know. I try to be objective about it, you know, not in a pity way. It's just the facts, you know. But when I was growing up, I was not aware that it was like, you know, the way that it would be perceived on, you know, an economic scale. So I loved the way I grew up. I wouldn't trade it for anything. And my parents always shielded us from any sort of, you know, us being aware of that. And we also grew up in a like middle class, lower middle class town where people didn't really talk about those things. And so that's why it kind of has that aesthetic of like not really wanting to talk about it because of pride and because of, honestly, it was not that bad. But if I look at it now, putting 8 people into a 2-bedroom apartment, a little apartment, is insane, you know? But I realizing, you know, I grew up like that, I didn't think about that. You know, I was always happy. My parents are very religious and, you know, they would go to the swap meet every weekend and sell just to, you know, just to get by and things like that. But we were like fucking really happy. You know, my parents were so loving. It wasn't perfect, but there is now, that's one of the tensions I do have, like writing about that. I feel like I kind of want to write about it to like inspire others who have gone through that. But at the same time, I don't want my family to think like, oh, he's like talking about us this way. It's kind of like stuck between a rock and a hard place, you know? Like if you do it, you feel great about like voicing your experience and how you overcame that, you know? I have like 4 or 5 books on the way when I grew up first generation low income, and I want people that grew up like that to be inspired. But at the same time, there's, you know, the Mexican idea of like not talking about your personal life, you know? So it's kind of like conflicted.
Is that something that you feel you get from Mexican cultures, the desire or the feeling that you shouldn't talk about your personal life?
Well, I mean, like in a book of poetry, you know what I mean? Like, there's the saying that you kind of keep with what's going on in your family within your family, you know what I mean?
Okay.
But I don't know, you know, I don't think Poverty is not anything anyone should ever be fucking ashamed of. It's the way
Yeah.
this country was built through racism, exploitation. And so that's why I write about it because, that's the way I grew up and there's no denying it. I overcame it. We're overcoming it. But don't ever think that I let anybody look down on me or anything like that because there's nothing you should be ashamed of. You were born into it. And, just the way that the structures are, people in the whites, they have advantage because they grew up here with generational wealth, and so I think that people shouldn't be ashamed of it, that you should be proud of your roots, so yeah, there's a bit of mixed feelings about it, I guess.
Yeah, I completely understand. Well, I can't say I completely understand you, but I resonate with this a lot because, on one hand, growing up in a impoverished, a differently economically abled background, whatever term you want to use for it, it's like I kind of just as a child didn't really think about it. I thought that was kind of the norm. Looking back on it, I realized how much hardship it was and how kind of I want everyone who's in that situation to be able to get more help. I want to advocate for more people to not have to have the kind of circumstances I had growing up. At the same time, there were some good things that came out of that, like I got to raise goats and chickens and pigs and have a lot more time with my family because my parents weren't really able to work. And so I got to have kind of economic instability, but I had like a familial stability that a lot of people don't get if they have parents who are working all the time. So I mean, it's like I want to both honor the good things that were there, but I also don't want to, put lipstick on a pig. I don't want to ignore the challenges either, but I think that's kind of what we as poets do. We look at those nuances, we delve into those nuances, and we say things like, it's this, but it's also that.
Like what is it, Whitman? I contain multitudes, you know what I mean? Like, not everything is so, even in my poem Bad Mexican, Bad American, not everything is this or that, black and white, And at the end of that poem, it says, you want to be remembered for how you treat people. And that's kind of what's important, regardless of the social class that you're in. Like, there's good people and bad people everywhere. And you just try your best, that existential quality of like, even if there's no meaning and everything is hard, like just try your best, maintain that personal dignity, and that's all you can really do,
Yeah. Are you familiar with Nikki Giovanni's poem, Nikki Rosa?
No, I'm not.
Okay. I won't read it here, but it's just another poem. And some of your work kind of reminded me of that poem because she talks about how, the first line is childhood remembrances are always a drag if you're black, and you always remember things like living in Woodlawn with no inside toilet. But then she goes on to talk about like, we have those things, but then we also have these other positive things. Some of your work kind of reminded me of that poem, and that poem, of course, kind of reminded me of my own feelings about the way I was raised and where I was raised.
Now, my sister is a big fan of her work.
Nikki Giovanni. Yeah, absolutely. Is your sister also a writer?
She is. She's an English major, and my older sister was an English major first, and then me, and then my younger sister. So there's three of us, and my youngest sister would write poetry, like great poetry, but then she quit. She ended up getting her master's at Harvard in public policy. And she kind of stopped writing poems. And I always tell my mom, like, if my sister wanted to, she could write a book like that. Like, she was very skilled. Like, she was always in like the honors and IB, and I was more like playing football and like the mainstream classes. And she was always like gifted, precocious, you know? So she's very good with like, she can speak like an academic more, you know? I kind of came like a little bit outside perspective, outsider perspective. So she's just very refined and polished, yet maintaining that like socially conscious grit. I think she might go back to it eventually, you know? Now she's busy with two kids that are just born the past couple of years, so.
Well, congratulations to her. I mean, I think about, Obama. I came across some of his poems a few years ago. It's like, yeah, he probably could have been a poet if he really wanted to be. He went into public policy and organizing, being president. But I have a feeling he'll write some more poems. We'll
I
find
hope
a
so.
collection in his journals later on in life or something. It's
Like Bush with the painting, the
I'm
portraits.
not making that
Not
comparison.
like that, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, sure, exactly. I often I was thinking about this very recently, like, well, what should we all like quit our jobs as poets and artists and writers and go work at trying to fix things on a, more practical level? Should we all become social workers and things like that? But I've kind of come to realize like the poetry can be very important too, and if that's the thing that you're called to do, then that's the thing you're called to do, and maybe don't question it so much, and let the people who feel called to the other things, let them do that, and you do you, and hope that we co-inspire each other and we work together, and trust that that's going to lead to positive outcomes. But yeah, it. We are getting close to the end of the hour, and I do want to ask a little bit about the two poems you read at the top. Which one would you say was the easiest one, and what made it easy for you?
Easiest to read or to write?
Right.
I think a lot of my work is similar. It's not like, I don't think they were, I don't remember if they were difficult or easy, but they tend to come easy to me. You know, I get in the zone and the inspiration. I'll write the initial draft, and if I need to, I'll go in there and maybe add some specificity of imagery or more detail, read it out loud for musicality. But luckily for me, this is like an obsession, and even if it looks on the surface to someone else like a lot of work, to me, I enjoy every second of it. Like I would be doing it if I couldn't make a living off of it, probably, you know. So even though there's a lot that goes into it and the submissions and everything, like that's like how I get high, you know, I get high off of that. Like I love every second of it. It doesn't feel like work at all to me. I think the workshops and teaching feels more like work, you know, but in a good way now, you know, it just takes a little more planning and lesson planning and organizing. But the creation, the writing process, I don't know if difficult is the right word for me or easy either. It's just more like natural, intuitive, and organic process, I think.
Well, let me ask it a different way, I guess. Because I read once some interview or some article where Billy Collins said something like, sometimes it takes a lot of false starts to get into the zone of the writing, but once he's in the zone, then the poems usually come easily, and he doesn't have to do a whole lot of revising. So I guess a useful question is, what do you do to get into that zone of writing?
I think maybe like if I was reading last week a lot, you know, I try to read every morning or like an hour or so, and just reading a lot, maybe some image will come to mind, like, okay, I want to eventually write something about a piñata or a skeleton and pyramid. You know, I like the French aesthetic of sort of playing with that French existential aesthetic when I was younger, wanting to wear black, smoking cigarettes. And so these are things that like kind of accumulate in my subconscious that I want to write about. And then, like I said, maybe I'll do a lot of reading for a week. And then next week, boom, I'll write one bad, kind of like bad rough draft poem. and the rest of them just come out sort of naturally, and there's not a lot of revision either. But also, I think it's more like all my philosophy of art, and I've had so much like going on in my life that kind of led to a lot of material to write about, you know?
Yeah.
And when you're Mexican American, you kind of have two different worlds to write about, and not just separate worlds, but how they clash as well, you know? So I don't really run out a lot of material, but also lately, a lot of my writing comes from the classes, my generative workshops. I write prompts. So the French existential prose poem came from a prompt that said, write about a special superpower you've somehow inherited. And so that's how I wrote. The first line just came to me of, after I fell down the stairs, I learned how to speak French. And so a lot of my current material comes from the workshops, writing prompts, and responding to show the writers how to respond, and so they can kind of like get the vibe of a response. And so that's why I think I have so many collections right now, is that first of all, it's my hobby and my passion, but also in my work life with a lot of the workshops I do, I have to write prompts anyway, you know?
Yeah, that's something I'm definitely finding is it does not hurt to have a day job where you're kind of required to do some writing every day. And I say this to folks at the Poetry Salon, sometimes, you know, we have groups of like 10 or 20 people who show up, and sometimes it'll be one person doing a drop-in, and they'll say like, oh, you know, it's just me. You don't need to stay on for me. And I go, no, I'm here to write. If you're not here, I'm going to write anyways. But if you're here, I know I'm going to actually really write. And that's kind of what has helped me get, and I would say sort of, I wouldn't say I'm always in the zone for writing, but it's like, it makes it a lot easier to access that zone for writing.
Yeah. And I think, you know, accessing the zone, you kind of always in the zone if you're always reading, you know what I mean? Like, I'm always reading in the morning, and I don't read a lot of prose. I don't read any prose really. So if you just read poetry and listen to music a lot with like great lyrics and musicality, and reading out loud in the morning, you know, I'm single, I don't have kids. So when I was in a relationship, I was happy, I was in love, but we were always going to some cafe and like always busy doing things. Mm-hmm. And now in sort of isolation, like I even go to the library on Sunday, you know, in La Habra. So there's an obsessive quality to it that led to all these books. But now that I finally have the books, I kind of want to be more balanced and, you know, probably start dating again eventually. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, and I think, you know, creative writing is a great way to go out. And, I mean, what is that line Robin Williams says in Dead Poets Society? It's like, you all write these poems to woo women. You know, so dating, writing poetry and being part of the poetry community is a great way to get out and take that stuff we do in solitude, but then have a place to go share it and be social again.
Yeah. And I was always so bad at that. Like, I would want to go to readings, and I think I'm kind of shy. And then I was just like issues about my weight. And so I just kind of avoided like readings. And now I'm trying to do more of that, put myself out there more. I have a reading tomorrow.
I saw that. I noticed that. Yeah. Tomorrow is the official book launch for Bad Mexican, Bad American. And it's in Los Angeles. I know, you know, by the time this interview drops, it'll have passed. So I hope some of the listeners were able to get out to go support the book and see you. And if not, then I hope there will be more places for people to come and hear you read live this book and the next couple of books that are coming out.
Yeah, and also I'll be at the Claremont reading in June, sharing some work with the Fourth Saturdays, I think it's called now, fourth Saturday's reading at the Claremont Library as well.
Well, fantastic. Are you planning a book tour at all?
Well, I'm going to Texas, El Paso Community College. I'm going to San Diego. So different areas have invited me. Planning a book tour is like, to me, has an economic factor as well. You know? I mean, like, so what I can afford, I'll do. What they pay me to go, I'll go. But good thing is that most of my work is online, so I can travel, you know, if they fund my readings. I can't really afford to just like pay to go somewhere myself. I could, yeah. But you know, my point is that if they invite me, they can fund it, get in contact with me, and we'll talk, you know.
There was a wonderful article that came out. I did my very first book tour back, was it June of 2023? Feels like a long time ago. But right after I got back, somebody messaged me a great article about how to do a do-it-yourself book tour. And I'm blanking on who wrote it, unfortunately. If I find it, I'll send it to you. I know there's a lot of great articles out there, you know, but in terms of like funding, one thing that I just found was useful is I only went to places where I had friends who would let me stay with them for free.
Yeah.
And one really useful piece of advice that I got was to contact your libraries where you're going to go do a book tour and ask if they want you to teach a workshop, because you know, that's a great way to basically get paid in every city you stop in to do your book tour. And then the main cost winds up being like, you know, the gas. So if you can manage to do a couple of cities that are close to each other or where there's a great, you know, Amtrak or Greyhound connection, it can actually be pretty economical, and you could actually break even on the work that you do.
I was going to say, you're probably just break even if you go on tour, you know, to be honest with you. But you know, yeah. I sell more books just online, you know. I got 28,000 followers on Twitter alone. So, like, I just put out there when I get books. And so most of mine is, like, selling copies online.
Do you really have 28,000 followers on Twitter?
Yeah.
How did you do that?
How?
Yeah. that's terrific. Congratulations.
Yeah. So most of the jobs that I get, it's online, you know, through Twitter, DMs, and things like that. So, you know, Twitter's kind of awful for a lot of reasons, but it's helped, like it's helped keep me employed, you know?
That's interesting. And yeah, I mean, who knows, by the time this airs and years later when people are listening to it for the first time, like, who knows what the situation with Twitter or X will be. Hopefully it'll be a place that's a little bit more friendly and anyways, hopefully it'll be a more user-friendly, human friendly place. But that is good to know, and yay to you. And I'm raising a high five hand for future success with this book and the next couple of ones.
You were asking like how I got the 28,000 followers.
Yeah,
I think
please.
People sense that to me, the online community poetry is like an outlet for me. Like in my everyday life, I don't have people to say, hey, I got published in the Yale Review. If I do say it, they'll be like, oh, well, how much did you get paid? $50. Oh, really? So you're bragging about $50? You know what I mean? Like, so online to me, I think the community senses that I appreciate their support and their friendship. And so that's why I think I've been able to get a lot of followers. Also, I'm always retweeting submission opportunities. You know, I think people sense my authenticity with it and how much it means to me. So I think this kind of has to do with it, you know?
No, absolutely. And yeah, I mean, it's very frustrating to me because I feel like a lot of, I'm going to cut some of that out because that's a longer discussion. But I will just say, I think that's a real testament to the way you can use social media to build an authentic community, because you're right. There's a lot of people who aren't poets who don't really get that the point of the poetry and the writing and getting a nice publication isn't because you're making money off of it. And connecting on social media allows us to connect with those people who do get it and to connect around the things that are of shared value to us that maybe other people don't quite recognize. So good for you for doing that and setting an example. I think I only know you because of your continuous posting, I think, through Instagram and Facebook. So I'm very glad that you you have been building that online following for yourself, because it means I get to read your book and talk to you about it. And we will have you featured at the Poetry Salon in March and also doing a workshop on the prose poem. And listeners to the Poetry Salon, by now, by the time you're hearing this, you've probably also gotten several emails reminding you or letting you know what dates and times we're going to have this. But Jose, thank you so much. Everyone else, whether you're a member of the Poetry Salon or not, please get the book, Bad Mexican, Bad American, good book from Acre Books. Jose, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you. Anytime. It's been a pleasure. See you at the reading.
See you soon.
Okay, take care.